Our fourth case for argument this morning is Baldwin Piano against Deutsch Wurlitzer.
Can we have some background?
Yes, but which?
Neither one nor neither one. Nice to know there are still fights going on in the higher art.
Mr. August.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This case involves the right to use the Wurlitzer trademark that was granted in 1985 as part of the sale of the appellant Deutsche Wurlitzer. Until 1985, Deutsche Wurlitzer was the jukebox manufacturing arm of the Wurlitzer company, the other arm of which was the Wurlitzer piano and organ business. Deutsche Wurlitzer was sold in 1985 as an ongoing business with the continuing right to call itself Deutsche Wurlitzer and to brand its goods with the Wurlitzer trademark. Because the Wurlitzer company retained its piano and organ business at that time, it could not convey the Wurlitzer trademark outright because of the basic rule of trademark law that two proprietors may not own the same mark if it's used for similar or related goods or services. So the rights were instead conveyed as a paid-up perpetual license that was attached to and expressly made part of the transaction documents by which Deutsche Wurlitzer was sold. This dispute arises because of the termination provision in that license agreement, specifically the following words: "This agreement shall continue in force without limit of period, but may be canceled by the licensor for material breach." Thus, we have a contract that is by its terms of indefinite duration, but which provides for fairly elaborate termination provisions in the case that Deutsche Wurlitzer breached that license. Those termination provisions provided for things such as written notice, 90 days to cure, the option of going for arbitration, with additional provisions regarding the situation where Deutsche Wurlitzer might be declared bankrupt or go into receivership or attempt to assign its business. A total of some 238 words in the termination provisions alone. This dispute arises because the Wurlitzer company later sold its Wurlitzer piano and organ business to Baldwin Piano Company. Baldwin then terminated the Deutsche Wurlitzer license without alleging breach, without giving any advance notice, and filed a suit for trademark infringement the very same day. Despite sworn statements from every one of the 1985 contracting parties to the contrary, the district court held that this license was terminable at will. And that was based on the mistaken belief that Illinois public policy required that holding, because contracts of indefinite duration, the court believed, are by definition terminable at will. Deutsche Wurlitzer here appeals the denial of Deutsche Wurlitzer's motion for summary judgment, the grant of Baldwin's motion for summary judgment, and the entry of a permanent injunction against continued use of the Wurlitzer trademark. The lower court's rulings are fundamentally wrong for three reasons. First, they're based on an incomplete reading of the license agreement, and because they're incomplete, they violate the basic principles of contract construction. Secondly, and perhaps most importantly, they ignore and frustrate the expressed intent of the contracting parties. And thirdly, they rewrite the license agreement in the name of a public policy that, in fact, has been misinterpreted and misapplied here. Let's look more closely at those errors. The district court violated two fundamental principles of contract construction. First, it failed to interpret the contract as a whole, giving effect to every provision. The lower court effectively stopped reading the trademark license agreement when it saw that it was of indefinite duration and may be terminated for material breach. As a result, the district court effectively ignored over 200 additional words in the termination provision. It is the law of Illinois, and I believe it's the law of every state of the union, that contracts are to be interpreted in a manner that gives effect to all provisions. And the law is to avoid an interpretation that renders some of those provisions meaningless or superfluous. The rulings of the lower court here impermissibly ignore and nullify the elaborate termination provisions contained in the license agreement. They also ignore the context in which that license agreement was negotiated, and that was the permanent sale of an ongoing business using that mark. Even more importantly, as a matter of contract construction, the lower court rulings violate the principle that the primary objective in construing a contract is to give effect to the intent of the parties. The district court gave lip service to that, recognized it as a rule, but then failed to apply it. This is a very unusual case because we have statements from each of the contracting parties and their lawyers, effectively everyone who was in the room in 1985, and they've all told us what their intent was, and they all shared the same intent, and that intent was that the license be terminable only for breach.
If you wanted to put in evidence like that, you don't put a zipper clause in the contract. You don't put a clause in the contract saying this contract is exclusive and don't listen to parole evidence.
You're referring to the integration clause, Your Honor?
The integration clause, sometimes called a zipper clause.
But also, Your Honor, it was expressly made.
Surely you don't think that the integration clause protects us when it helps, but when it hurts us, let's just ignore it.
I don't think that it requires, with all due respect, that the court ignore the fact that it also was made part of the purchase and sale agreement and that the parties are expressing their intent now that that was not what they intended to accomplish. The lower court, despite knowing the intent of all the parties, and we had statements also from the counsel who were responsible for drafting this agreement.
Look, it's all completely inadmissible. Let's just argue this case within the four corners of the contract.
Well, even if we look at the four corners of the contract, the court essentially held that the contract was unambiguous and that, in the court's view, it unambiguously stands for the proposition that the contract was terminable at will based on a perception of Illinois public policy that, and I quote, as a matter of Illinois public policy, such perpetual contracts are terminable at will. And that is just not the way Illinois law works. The lower court imposed its own interpretation in the mistaken belief that Illinois public policy requires that all contracts of indefinite duration be terminable at will as a sort of per se rule, regardless of the intent of the parties, regardless of contrary language in the contract, and regardless of the context. The lower court relied primarily on a decision by the Illinois Supreme Court, a 1998 decision authored by Justice Heupel, the Jesperson versus 3M decision.
It doesn't matter who the author of the decision is, not in this court, not on the Supreme Court of Illinois.
In the Jesperson decision, the court was looking at a contract for the distribution of 3M products. So it was a contract that involved an ongoing business relationship that 3M no longer wanted to continue. And the court wrote, and I quote, perpetual contracts are disfavored. Merely disfavored. It was not that they are forbidden, that they are never allowed, but the rationale was given.
Does Illinois, by the way, still follow the rule against perpetuities in trust law?
Mm-hmm. As a trademark lawyer, Your Honor, that I cannot tell you.
That's all right. I'll fill in for you. Yes, it does. Go ahead.
So it's one of the minority that's still locked into good 17th century British law about
right
contract duration.
Thank you for helping out, Your Honor. The rationale for this public policy is that conditions change, business people need the flexibility to roll with the punches, and they shouldn't be locked into any kind of business relationship for longer than they specifically agreed to be locked into it. That was the general rule, and the court went on to say that there is a major exception, and that's where the agreement, while of indefinite duration, does provide that it's terminable for cause or upon the occurrence of a specific event, as is the case in this agreement. It provides that, the Jesperson case, that is, provides that when a contract of indefinite duration provides that it may be terminated upon the occurrence of a specified event or for cause, then it is terminable only upon the occurrence of that specified event and not at will. It looked to a case from the Michigan Supreme Court, the Lignovsky
v. Ziebart. Were we still quoting Heibel's opinion, or the Supreme Court opinion authored by Heibel?
Yes.
So you're obviously, that's the whole thrust of your argument. Judge Zagel, nonetheless, this is quoting Judge Zagel in his order, nonetheless, the Illinois Supreme Court held that this contract was terminable, speaking of Jesperson, was terminable at will despite the presence of such limiting language. He's just wrong on that. Then.
We believe that the lower court failed to appreciate the exception announced, not necessarily announced, but confirmed in the Jesperson case.
It's not an exception, as I understand it. What they say in this opinion, I think they try to sum up their holding with the words, when a contract is indefinite in duration, the delineation of instances of material breach in the contract of a permissive and non-exclusive termination provision will not create a contract terminable for cause. So your argument has to be that the list in this contract is exclusive rather than permissive. That's the question posed by Jesperson.
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. That is what we are arguing. And the basis for that is largely the Jesperson's decision.
No, the basis for understanding this contract does not lie in Jesperson.
Well,
what is the reason why you think this contract, read within its four corners, has an exclusive termination relation rather than a permissive one?
Because of the very language of the contract, Your Honor, that says that it shall continue without limit of period, but may be terminated by the licensor, for material breach. And the termination provision was so detailed that to say that that was not an exclusive basis for termination would render essentially everything else relating to termination of no effect.
Why are you relying on the list rather than the introductory language? The introductory language says, except as herein provided.
Well, in our briefing, Your Honor,
I would take that as the best indicator of exclusivity.
And
there's nothing parallel to the except as herein provided language in the contract at issue in Jesperson.
Thank you, Your Honor. And we have argued that in our briefs. So
you're into your rebuttal time.
Thank you. So Deutsche Wurlitzer's position here is that the dispute should not be resolved by judicial resort to a general preference of Illinois public law when you have a contract like this one where the party's intent is clear and there's no public policy that requires the court to disregard the intent of the parties or the language of the contract. The greater public good would be for courts to uphold the language of contracts that have been negotiated by the parties. So for these reasons, we ask the court to reverse, and I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. August. Mr. King.
May it please the court, my name is Robert King. I represent the appellee Baldwin Piano. The district court entered partial summary judgment in favor of Baldwin Piano and entered a permanent injunction prohibiting Deutsche Wurlitzer from using the Wurlitzer marks, which they had previously used pursuant to a license agreement. The only challenge on appeal made by Deutsche Wurlitzer is the argument that the license agreement was improperly terminated. The district court had held in two prior rulings that the license agreement was of indefinite duration and therefore terminable at will pursuant to Illinois law, which govern the contract.
Do you agree with that position?
Yes.
Okay.
It's clear that Illinois still follows the rule that contracts of indefinite duration are deemed terminable at will.
Well, that's not what the Supreme Court said in Jesperson. I've read what I think is their holding. It said, when a contract is indefinite in duration, the delineation of instances of material breach of a permissive and non-exclusive provision will not create a contract terminable for cause. So the question, I think, is not what Illinois law provides. That's reasonably clear. The question is how one understands this contract. Is this an exclusive list or a permissive list?
It is a permissive list.
And why do you read it as a permissive list?
I read it that way because that's the indication that we got from the Illinois Supreme Court in Jesperson.
No, Jesperson does not construe this contract. I've read you what I deem the holding of Jesperson. Stop talking about it. Talk about this contract. Why, in the structure of the language of this contract, do you deem this permissive rather than exclusive?
Because the contract provides that only that it may be terminated for breach, and any contract may be terminated for breach.
What do you do about the language that said, except as herein provided?
Your Honor,
that's what seems to me the best evidence of exclusivity. How do you read that?
Very similar language was present in Jesperson.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. And if I could point, Your Honor, to it, in the reply brief of the appellant, they cited to the...
Let's look at Jesperson. The full language of the clause is in the court's opinion. It says, right to terminate... And then it says, Trimline may, upon not less than 30 days' notice, terminate this agreement for any of the following reasons. And then there's a list.
Excuse me, Your Honor, if I might, there's another paragraph in Jesperson that is pertinent. In the appellate decision in Jesperson, they cite the entire paragraphs completely. And here's what they say at paragraph 2.05. It says, term, unless terminated as hereinafter provided in Article 4, this agreement and the appointment of the distributor hereunder shall continue in force indefinitely and govern all transactions between the parties. Then in section 4.01, it says...
tell us what termination does. Look, I really want you to stop talking about Jesperson and talk about this contract.
Your Honor, the accept language that you've pointed to was present in Jesperson.
I can't force you to do that. If you don't want to talk about this contract, you can thump away on Jesperson.
I do, Your Honor. My point is this. The language that you've focused on, except as provided here and after, is very similar to the language that was present in Jesperson. And the Illinois Supreme Court did not believe that that language created an exclusive termination provision. That, coupled with the use of the word may, which again was present in the Jesperson decision, is what caused the Supreme Court to hold that that provision was not exclusive. We have that same situation here. Moreover, because of the use of the word may, as was pointed out, all contracts may be...
How much do you think Wurlitzer could have gotten for its subsidiary if it had taken in 1985 the position that the trademark may be canceled at any time and for no reason?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
I can tell you the answer to that. Nothing.
I disagree with you.
It would have made the contract worthless.
I disagree with you completely, and here's why. The purchase and sale agreement, paragraph 6A, provides that in the event that nothing in the license agreement will inhibit the company from using the words Deutsche Wurlitzer as its corporate name.
Yes.
If it had been the intent of the parties that the license might never be terminated under any circumstance, then you wouldn't have that provision because you wouldn't need it. So with all due respect, what they bought when they bought the business was a business that produced products. At that time, it used a certain trademark on those products. There was nothing in the agreement that said you are required to use those trademarks going forward or that you may decide that it's not worth your while to use those trademarks on those goods. You might evolve different trademarks over time. There was nothing that restricted their ability to do it.
That the world could have evolved in a way in which Wurlitzer became a swear word, right, and or worse, was adopted by the government as a word of propaganda, and they would have wanted to run screaming in the other direction. But of course, that wasn't the question. The question was, what would happen if you thought, under this contract, the next day you could be canceled and the plug pulled on your existing business?
And the answer is, as a matter of Illinois contract law, when you enter into a perpetual contract, that is a risk that you run. And they could have chosen some other state's law to apply to this transaction, but they didn't. They chose Illinois. And under Illinois law, perpetual agreements are terminable at will. And the other provisions of that Article 13 that Butch Wurlitzer refers to don't give us any indication of what the duration of the agreement is. After all, that is the real question that we're faced with when we look at these type of contracts. Is there something that tells us when the contract will end? That is definite and objective?
Under this contract, it's perfectly straightforward. It will end either when the sun expands and swallows the earth in 4 billion years, or when one of those events listed occurs.
No, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. Because of the use of the word may, it is indefinite. That's what the Illinois Supreme Court said.
That's what I don't understand. No one would write a contract to compel Baldwin to terminate on the event of when one of those events. When one of those three things happens, Baldwin has an option, but not an obligation. But you seem to be saying whenever a contract is written to give the licensor an option, it also gives them an option to terminate with no reason. But that's a very strange way to understand options.
The reason for that, Your Honor, is when you do it in the way it was done in this contract and in Jesperson, you don't create an objective event that tells you when the contract will end. This reflects, in part, the Illinois law's hostility to perpetual contracts. And therefore, if you're going to do it,
I must say, I just don't see that in Jesperson. Jesperson says, I won't read it again.
Well, Your Honor, the way the Illinois Supreme Court phrased the issue in the introductory part of its opinion focuses on the use of the word may. That's what was significant to the court. It showed that it was not exclusive, and that's exactly what is present here. And as the district court found, there was no other interpretation that George Wurzel came forward with that made any sense either. They wanted to ignore the language may and just simply read that out of the contract as well. Our position is that the other things that follow in Article 13 simply don't give you a durational term. They're remedies. They're not durational terms. So unless the court has further questions, I think that the issue is fairly drawn here. We believe that the language that Judge Easterbrook has focused upon, except as otherwise provided, was present in the Jesperson contract. We believe the use of the word may makes this a non-exclusive termination provision, making the contract terminable at will. For those reasons, we would ask that the district court's opinion be affirmed. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. King. Anything further, Mr. August?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel apparently now appears to be hanging its hat on use of this term may. This very appellate court has actually addressed a contract of indefinite duration that had the may language and looked at Illinois common law and ruled in the first Commodity Trainers versus Heinhold just 10 days before the Wurlitzer license was executed that I quote, provision that says either party may unilaterally terminate this agreement for a breach of any of the paragraphs of this agreement means that it is not terminable at will because it sets forth a specific event upon which the contract may be terminated. The other point that was raised by counsel, Your Honors, is that there was really no need for an independent right to use Wurlitzer as a trademark because there was already the independent right to use the trade name Deutsche Wurlitzer. But that ignores, Your Honors, that there is a difference at law between a trademark and the right to use it and a trade name and the right to use that. In 1985, Deutsche Wurlitzer bargained for and paid for both the right to call itself Deutsche Wurlitzer and to put out Wurlitzer-branded goods. So if Your Honors have no further questions, appellant Deutsche Wurlitzer prays for reversal and rests its case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.